Hey everybody, welcome back to the Treatment Free Beekeeping Podcast for another episode. Today I have on with me Michael Mehar, who is from the Treatment Free Beekeeping group. He's one of our moderators now, our newest moderator. He is, we're going to be talking about, what did we talk about? We talked about mentoring, and we talked about honey and prices, and we talked about some other stuff. It's a really good conversation, so stick around for that. This episode brought to you, as always, by the patrons at patreon.com/TFB. And I have now just added a new function to, if you want to become a supporter of the podcast and Facebook group and all the rest. And that is a new closed Facebook group where you get to be in a group with other supporters of Treatment Free Beekeeping. So closed Facebook group, direct access to me. You get your questions answered first on Q&A shows, all that good stuff. So if you want to be a part of that, just a dollar gets you in the door. It's called the TFB Pub. So you can check that out if you're a patron. Other stuff, you can find my videos at, YouTube, just search for Treatment Free Beekeeping, or I think it's YouTube/Treatment Free Beekeeping, whatever it is. You can find show notes for this podcast at tfb.podbean.com. If you're listening to this, subscribe at tfb.podbean.com. You can also subscribe, through iTunes or wherever you can. You can get your podcasts. I'm also going to do a new thing. If you leave me a 5-star review, I will read it on the show. So that'll be fun also. Without further ado, here it is. Here's a show with Mike. Welcome to the show, Mike. Thanks for joining me here today to talk about bees and other stuff. I met you through the Facebook page, and you've now become one of my moderators on the Treatment Free Beekeeping Facebook group. Why don't you tell me how you got started in beekeeping and your experience and where you are and all that good stuff.
Well, thanks for having me. I live in just north of Van Buren, Arkansas. It's kind of on the Arkansas-Oklahoma border, right off the I-40. And I've been keeping bees for about 5 years now. I haven't been a treatment-free beekeeper the whole time. Basically, I'm an organic gardener, and I really just got tired of going out and hand-pollinating all of my squash and zucchini plants year after year. So I thought about getting into bees to help with that mainly. I was a zoology major in school, so I've always had an interest in different types of animals. And I just decided, one day I wanted to get bees. I didn't want to just jump in like a lot of people do. I wanted to do some research. So I spent about 2 years, reading books, going to, our local beekeeping club. I took a class from the local extension service on keeping bees before I got my first hive. I bought a nuke from a man who lives in Siloam Springs. I'm sorry, not Siloam Springs, Hot Springs. It's not exactly local in my area, but it was still within my state. And I only bought one hive up front. I kept it for a full year, and I just started making splits and going from there. I've never bought any type of commercial pesticides for treatments, but I did get into the whole essential oil kind of niche. I did that for a couple of years. It worked well for what it was, but the more I learned about bees, and I eventually let my zoology education kind of take over and just realized that the only real way to keep bees in a responsible way is to just go completely treatment free. And, let genetics take over and do its job. And, for the last 2 years now, I've been treatment free completely. No beetle traps, no chemicals, no essential oils. And I've also switched over from the standard deep high bodies with the medium supers to complete all mediums. And now that I've done it, I wish I didn't do it all at once. Wish I would have known better up front. There are some difficulties in that, but now I'm an all medium, completely treatment free keeper, and that's the way I plan on staying.
Awesome. So you were right there. I was up in just south of Fayetteville, so you were down south of me there.
Yeah, if you hop on a Highway 59, one of the last exits before you get off of I-40 going to Oklahoma, I might be a 10-minute drive north up the road. I mean, I can be on I-40 in 10 minutes or less.
Right on. Cool. Yeah, it's kind of interesting to hear from people who like I got to know a few beekeepers when I was back there and sold some queens and nukes and things, but I didn't meet them all for sure. So still meeting them now that I don't live there anymore.
Yeah, that's how it always goes. Our local club, we generally average close to 100 members. I would have never thought there are that many people in this one little area that keep bees. But now I'm surprised every year by all the new faces I see after all the beginner classes.
Well, that's part of why I wanted to have you on to talk today is about mentoring. I do just a little bit of mentoring, but it's not on a consistent basis. I'll have people who are in the area and they want to stop and check out my hives and hear what I have to say and practice grafting or something like that. And whenever I have a chance, I give them the opportunity to do that. But I don't have like a new beekeeper that I'm starting out with and kind of teaching them the ropes. And so that's why I wanted to talk to you, because you do a little more of that and you can give our less experienced beekeepers some tips on how to best take advantage of mentors that they might have in their area.
Sure. Yeah, I've done it a couple of different ways. You know, I've directly helped a few different beekeepers over the years, actually, you know, going out to their individual hives. I've also, as part of our club, we have had some create some burning hives that, you know, we'd have 10 to 15 members that would come out once a month, and we would show them, you know, try to show them hands-on different things inside of hives and different techniques. And it's kind of a different learning. I don't even know how to put it. It's very different than being one-on-one with somebody. The biggest thing I found is newer beekeepers tend to want to watch more than get their hands in there and actually do. And depending on your mentor, that might be what they're looking for. Myself, I would rather have somebody get in and do, and then would rather just stand beside and kind of watch and teach and help as needed. So I would tell people, when you're looking for a mentor, find one that fits your style. You know, really talk to them. I wouldn't just go to a club and say, hey, I'm looking for a mentor. Who wants to be my mentor? I mean, you need to get to know some of the beekeepers, maybe go visit their operation and see how they do it, because you might end up getting a mentor that, you know, does things nothing like what you would want to do. And it's never going to turn out good if that happens. I tend to be more direct, more straightforward. I don't really like to beat around the bush, and that can come off as abrasive to some people, but that's just how I prefer to be. I'd rather just tell you, no, you shouldn't do this, or this is, causing this issue, because I would rather not spend 10 or 15 minutes trying to, beat around the bush at it. So in my case, I found that I'm probably not as good as mentoring one-on-one with people. There's not a lot of people around here, beekeeper-wise, with my personality type that I'd really mesh with. So that's why I've started this year doing a lot of my own teaching videos on YouTube through my beekeeping page, so people can watch it and they don't have me standing over their shoulder. And, if they see something they don't like, they always have the option to turn it off, instead of being stuck in a yard with me where they can't get away. That would be my biggest tip, is just to get to know the person that you think you want to be your mentor, instead of just, sticking your hand up in the air and saying, hey, who wants to be my mentor? And then just, you know, regretting it down the road.
You have a lot of people trying to get away?
I don't know if they would tell me that to my face. I think more, as bad as it might sound, I think it's more me trying to get away sometimes.
Just realizing that this person isn't.
Yeah, that's not going to work. Like, if just hypotheticals, if I've been helping them out on and off for 4 or 5 months and they still can't light a smoker, I know they haven't been at home trying to do it on their own. They're basically just waiting for me to do it for them. And that's not how my method is. I mean, I actually want you to put some effort into it, do some learning before you come looking for a mentor. You know, if the first time we open a hive and I hand you a hive tool and you go, what's that? I'm going to assume that you've never looked at anything on your own or tried to learn anything on your own. And it kind of scares me. As bad as that sounds, it's true.
Now, I understand. One of the pieces of advice that I've been giving out for the last, I don't know, half a year or so, is when you start out beekeeping, find a mentor who is close to the way that you want to do things, your philosophies. So for myself, you know, I'm a treatment-free beekeeper. I've always been a treatment-free beekeeper. When I first started researching into how to keep bees and what to do and how to do the whole thing, I pretty quickly discovered that there were just a couple of people out there who were doing it treatment-free, and I thought that treatment-free was the way to do it because, you know, they're wild animals. They should be able to handle business on their own. So when you raise your hand in a beekeeping meeting like that and say, I need a mentor or whatever, you're getting into a relationship that might be fundamentally incompatible with you. I mean, you can think about it like dating. You're not going to go on a date with somebody, you know, if you're a vegan and a member of PETA, you're probably not going to go on a date with somebody who's a cattle rancher or something. Sure. It's just a matter of compatibility. So find somebody that is doing what you want to do, because when you first start out, you really don't have a framework from which to decide what are the right things to do here and there.
Yeah. And I wish I had a mentor when I started. Basically, you know, whatever I read and what I learned in classes, that was my mentor. So, you know, I started the traditional way, you know, with deeps and mediums. And, you know, if I had somebody to talk to who was more of, you know, my frame of mind of thinking, you know, I would have started off with all mediums. I would have started off small cell and then mixed in some foundationalists like I do now. I spent basically 2 or 3 years of beekeeping, you know, making bees and making frames and drawing out foundation just to turn around and sell it all because I switched sizes. Now looking back, I realized how much time I really wasted learning, you know, what I really wanted. And I really would have liked to have had that experience from people up front. But most everybody around that I met that I know, that's the only way they did it. And I didn't know any better. And now I'm hoping that, you know, kind of the contrarian beekeeper that does things a little bit differently, you know, maybe I can give them some ideas that might help them along the way. In our area, there's still not a lot of people that are true treatment-free. There's a lot of the, I don't really use chemicals, but I use different kinds of beetle traps and Swiffer sheets. And I mean, I might know 2 or 3 real true treatment-free keepers. So anybody in this area wanting to find a mentor like that, it's still pretty hard for them. And, you know, there's other beekeepers around here that aren't in our local group. But I don't imagine that they're treatment free just from, you know, the dynamic of the people that I already know in the area that's been doing it all these years. So it can be tough. I mean, I know people right now who are looking for mentors that I would be happy to mentor them, but I can already see from things they post and pictures that they post and the way they talk about their bees that it would not be a good fit. So I don't even volunteer because I know what the end result's going to be.
Why don't you give us some examples of that sort of thing you're talking about right there? What things do you see that you're like, that's not a good fit for me?
Offhand, way to put me on the spot.
I know what you're talking about. I just want to hear.
Yeah, it's hard to just off the hand to think. Well, like a big thing is I don't use queen excluders between my brood chambers and my honey supers. I let them have a completely unrestricted brood nest. If my brood gets to 5 or 6 mediums tall, you know, so be it. And I already see a lot of people that are dead set on, you know, you can't let brood get up into the supers. Your brood can only be, you know, 2 deeps or 4 mediums deep, and you have to have this excluder and X amount of supers. And I know most likely from reading their posts and seeing their things on different groups, not just locally, just, you know, all over the internet, that's not somebody that, you know, I'm not going to be able to change their mind no matter what I say to them. It's just going to be a losing battle. And since I do my style without queen excluders, there's no meshing the two. It's either or.
And it is definitely a different method.
Yes. I use top entrances. I mean, I'm in Arkansas. It's hot. It's humid. You know what it's like here. Yesterday, the heat index was 109. Today, a storm came through and it's 83. I know people that are dead set against top entrances. I like to use them in July and August when it's really hot and humid. So, you know, I'm not going to try to be somebody's mentor and force them into using something just because I use it. You know, if they want my advice, I'll give it to them, but I'm not going to try to make them take it.
And with a top entrance, especially when you get into a hive that has a top entrance, the internal configuration of the hive a lot of times is going to be totally different. So you're not going to you're not going to find stuff in the same spot where you'd find it normally.
And then that's how I do my hive. So if I have somebody at my place and I'm trying to teach them, and they're going home, you know, to a completely different, you know, flipped over setup, I'm not really doing them any good. I'm just harming them in the long run, you know, in my own opinion. So, you know, for me, mentoring, it's hard to find people. And also, not just philosophy, and I don't mean this badly, but age-wise, for me, it's easier to find a mentor that's closer to me in age just because of the speed that I work on things, and I like to work in the hotter weather still. And, you know, somebody who's 30 or 40 years older than me may not be able to physically do that. And it's going to really restrict times of day and how I can teach them to do things. So, you know, them finding a mentor that's more suited for those conditions for them, you know, that's something they need to look at. You know, I know people that run only deeps. Deeps are their supers. I mean, they'll have a box or hive that's 6 boxes tall of deeps. Well, I don't have the greatest back. That's one reason I switched to mediums. And depending on, you know, if they're trying to do comb honey or however they're trying to do their setup, them being all deeps and me being all mediums, it's going to cause issues. So, you know, they need to find somebody that's more like them. It's just a lot of little things that add up that just make mentors just not always the greatest, you know, fit for some people.
And you can a lot of times get an idea of someone's attitude toward things. Like one of the ones that sticks out to me is feeding. Like I try not to feed as much as possible. Like that's a specific goal. There's some people that will never feed whatsoever, and more power to them. And there's other people that, you know, feed their bees like they can't survive without being fed. And that's definitely something that's not what I'm into.
Yeah, like right now, I have 13 nukes in my backyard. That started a few weeks ago. You know, it's July here. It's hot. They're brand new nukes. I took what frames of honey I could that were excess off ever hives and gave to some of them. But about half of them, I have to feed them. It's just this time of year. If I would have gotten them started earlier, I wouldn't have. Like some ever nukes that I did do that way, they've never seen a drop of food because of the flow was on. But, I mean, you just have to do, in my opinion, you have to beekeep with what Mother Nature gives you. I mean, if it's hot and dry, you're going to feed. And, you know, if it comes down to it, if you don't have the excess honey to put inside the hive from, you know, from other resources. Yeah, and there's those people that are never going to do that. And it's just not going to work when I'm trying to show them how to make nukes later, you know, throughout the summer. The same with people that like to refer to their bees as their girls.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
And I guess it's a pet peeve, naming hives. I don't name hives.
For me as well. Not to say that there's anything wrong with that. No, I'm just saying, yeah.
It's just the mentality. I mean, if I'm putting a lid on and I crush 10 bees, I crush 10 bees. I'm not going to get upset about it. It is what it is. You know, if anything in my hives, if I can't tell what they are by colors, they get a number stuck on the front of them just so I can keep track for that season. Season to season, it changes. Sometimes I don't change numbers. I'm not real into keeping track of how long my queen's been alive and when she gets superseded. If there's a queen in there and going, that's all I'm worried about. I'm not going through every year and requeening just because she's gotten old. And the bees know when she's too old and when they need to replace her, and I just let them take care of it. So I don't really have a need to track hives on that specific, you know, down to that specific hive and that name of that hive and that name of that super and the name of that upper super. I guess I'm not that into it. I don't know how to put it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. With the thing with the girls, calling them girls, that's, and especially naming the queen and things like that. Let me put it this way. You don't name the bacon pig, right? You don't name.
Unless you name it bacon.
Well, yeah. You don't name the cow that you're saving up. You know, you don't name the Thanksgiving turkey. And with treatment-free beekeeping especially, when you start naming things and start getting too close to them emotionally, I find that leads to, that honestly, I mean, it leads to treating. It leads to being excessively concerned with survival, and in treatment-free beekeeping, you know, if you name your queen Janet or something, and you love Janet, and Janet's a great hive, but at the end of the year, Janet has a massive mite infestation, and, you know, you just got to let Janet handle Janet's business.
Yeah, I think I fell into that type of thinking when I started.
No offense to anybody named Janet.
No. It's like, I think that's why I started the essential oils, because I was more, I think like most new beekeepers, I was so concerned about not losing any hives. And I didn't want to use chemicals, but I thought, well, that's a softer chemical. It's not as bad. But I never took into account, you know, what it really means, you know, how much I was really propping them or helping aid them. But, you know, I was proud, you know, for 3 or 4 years that I'd gone 4 years and I haven't lost a single hive ever. And I thought that was, you know, really great. And then I decided, well, you know, it's time. I need to go completely treatment free. I know I'm going to lose some, you know, I just realized, you know, I accepted the fact that I'm going to lose some. I could lose a lot. It just, you know, I didn't really know which hives were stronger than others because I'd been treating them all with the same, you know, regimens basically. And, I decided to do that the same year that I decided to switch everybody to all medium. And that probably wasn't the smartest thing to do because that was just an extra stress that I put on top of them. And out of, I want to say at that time, after I sold nukes, I probably had 11 or 12, you know, decent, good size hives that should have overwintered. I just went cold turkey, didn't do anything to them all year long. I ended up with one going into the next spring. So I decided, you know, that's the one that can take it. And, you know, that's going into this spring. So this year I started off with one hive. You know, I had a lot of extra drawn comb and things left over from the previous ones. And, you know, I started reproducing everybody from, I keep saying everybody like they're people, but every hive from there. And that's part of what I'm doing on my page. I'm kind of showing people how you can have one hive, even, you know, worst case scenario, you have one hive that's left and how you can use that one hive to bulk up and rebuild for the next year. Be prepared, you know, see which hive can survive that year and just kind of do that over year and year. Just, you know, the basic treatment-free principle of, you know, making more bees and making more bees, and you're going to lose some bees. And that's, you know, that's how nature works. And you just, the quicker you accept that, the better off you're going to be.
I agree. I've been saying this for many, many years. It's tough. It's hard to, especially when you've invested money in this system and if you've bought bees, it's really hard to, at the end of the day, let it go. you know, let the bees deal with what they need to deal with. That's the hard part of treatment-free beekeeping. Losing hives is the difficult part. Now, if you started by catching swarms, or a little less so with cutouts. Cutouts require a lot of effort. But, catching swarms, especially this year, I put out about 30 swarm traps. I have currently, recovered 7 swarms, and I still got 20 of my, at least 15 of my swarm traps still out in the field that I have not checked. So who knows what's out there. But those bees, I put them all, I started a new yard this year, and I put all the swarm bees in the same yard. And come next spring, I will know that whatever's in that yard is swarm bees from the previous year. And I don't have to worry about, losing anything, because they were all free. And if they die, then all I got to do is take those swarm traps back out and catch some more. So, it's a whole different mindset, and it is kind of less feeling. Like there are different types of people and personality types, and somebody like me is going to remember that an animal is an animal, and, not try to make a friend out of it. But not everybody is that way. And, we need to meet somewhere in the middle on that one.
Yeah. Basically everybody's just turning every animal into dogs, cats, which they're not.
Yes. They're not.
Ever my dog and cats, I can like it. I can pet it, and I can turn around and eat it. It's fine with me. Yeah, I think that's just, you know, that's the truth of it. I mean, it's, when we bred different animals for different purposes, you know, and, you know, we're keeping bees. I mean, you know, people keep bees for enjoyment, for honey, you know, for different reasons, but they're still insects. They have a completely different kind of reproductive timeline than other animals. They're just a whole different thing. And I try to keep thinking of them as a thing more than a girl and her boys. And I do, you know, I do occasionally refer to them as girls when I'm talking about bees to somebody else. But in my head, I'm not thinking, you know, I'm not applying that to them. I'm just using that word to convey, you know, whatever message I'm trying to get across to like a friend of mine. And a lot of times I'll say that too, because they don't realize the majority of the bees in a hive most of the year are girls. So I just kind of say girls instead of boys. But, you know, in terms of that, like myself, I bought one nuke to start out with. That's the only bees I've ever bought. So 2 or 3 years down the line, if I lose 2 or 3 hives, it's not a big deal. You know, of course, if I had started out with 20 nukes that I bought and I lost 15 of them, I would be pretty devastated. I'm sure I can't say that I wouldn't be sticking all kinds of things in the hives to try to get them through to just, you know, I would tell myself, oh, I'll get them to the next season. Then I'll go treatment free. And then the same thing would happen the next season. And I would say it again and over again. So I just decided to cut the cord now while it's, you know, 5 years in instead of 15 years in. And I'm really, really set in my ways. And that's a hard thing to convey to new beekeepers, especially, you know, getting back to the mentoring. You know, if your mentor's been doing it 30 years and they've lost, you know, 100 hives over time, and then you have this brand new person that's bought their 1 or 2 nukes, and the beekeeper is like, oh yeah, that's a goner. You know, shake the bees out, you know, do whatever to them. You know, we're crushing them in the lid, you know, or oh, they're too aggressive. We're just going to seal them up, stick them out in the field and let them die, which I've had, you know, people do that too. You know, it's pretty devastating to a new beekeeper, and that can really turn them off from getting a good mentor. And there's nothing saying that mentor is bad. It's just they've got all those years of experience and they've kind of desensitized themselves, you know, detached themselves from where that new beak is, that, you know, they just don't have that foresight yet. And that really comes into play. I think if you get a really seasoned, you know, mentor that's been doing it 20, 30 years, and you get this, you know, really hopeful brand new beak that buys a nuke or two and they're going to save all the bees. And then, you know, reality hits, you know, it's, I don't know if that's why more people don't offer to mentor. It seems like there's always more people, you know, people around here that I know nationally, I have no idea. It seems like to me, there's always more people looking for mentors than there are mentors available. Even though, you know, you might have 10 people looking for a mentor out of a beekeeping group of 100, you know, there's 90 other seasoned beekeepers there that live all around you within driving range, but you don't generally see very many of them offering their time. And, you know, I don't really know how to fix that. I don't know if there is any fixing that. And over time it wears on you. I'm sure people, mentors that go through a lot of students, you know, it wears on them having to go through that cycle year after year, just going to beginning beekeeping classes year after year. That wears me out, just sitting there hearing the same questions and seeing the same people sometimes 2 or 3 years in a row taking the same class over and over again. You know that they're missing something somewhere and they need some help, but you don't really know how to help them. And I don't really know, you know, how to fix that. I'm not sure where to go from here.
You made some really good points in that one. I just wanted to say, one of the things going back to properly understanding what a hive is, when you have a cat or a dog or a kid or, I mean, kid in the sense of child or goat works too. If something happens to that cat, dog, or child, like that cat, dog, or child is gone. They have worth in a way as an individual that bees don't have, because a beehive is not an individual. It's, mm-hmm. it's made up of thousands, tens of thousands of members, number one. Number two, virtually all of those members, all but one of them, has a very limited lifespan, like 6 weeks. So you constantly have members of this hive dying every day and being created every day. And so we get stuck in this idea. We treat bees like dogs and cats where, you know, if I have my cat, you know, my childhood cat growing up was named Cece. And Cece, something happened to Cece, and she crawled under my parents' bed and she died one night. She wasn't young. I mean, she was an older cat, so whatever. But Cece's gone. And perhaps had Cece gotten some veterinary care, had we noticed that she was having something wrong, she wouldn't have died and she'd have lived longer, but she had eventually died anyway. And the difference with a hive is, it's not an individual. If a hive dies, even queens are regularly replaced by the hive. There is no set thing that is a hive. So when you lose one, I mean, the only difference between a dead hive and a live hive is the dead hive doesn't have live bees in it. Mm-hmm. You know, so when I lose a hive going through winter, and, you know, I go check the yards, say once a month or something, just to see who's all still alive out there. I come on a dead hive. It doesn't mean that much to me because, number one, I have other live hives. Number two, I didn't pay for them, so I'm not that worried about them dying. Number three, I know that weak hives should die or should be replaced. And number four, I don't have to worry about that hive now. I can take the equipment back to the garage and repurpose things and remanufacture things and clean it all up. Like I'm not treating a hive like an individual. Like if I have something great and wonderful and it dies, then I've lost something great and wonderful, you know, like a dog or even more in the sense of a child. It's just an entirely different mindset that I think that we don't teach new beekeepers. And I think it's very important, especially in treatment-free beekeeping, because we have to understand, we have to grasp the fact that everything passes away, the mortality of it all, through natural selection and other natural processes.
Yeah, the way I've tried to explain it to a few new beaks, and I got some interesting looks. You know, I basically, you know, explained that, you know, a hive is a superorganism, and say, stop thinking about them as bees. Think of them as ants. Okay, pretend there it was an ant colony in that box. It's like, okay, so are you going to start referring to all the ants as your girls? Would you name the queen? Would you go out and name each different mound, give it different names? And they will say, you know, well, no, of course not. They're ants. I'm like, well, what's the difference? I mean, just because you're getting something that you want from bees, it's essentially the same thing.
That's exactly, you know, right.
You have to stop thinking of it as, oh, these cute fuzzy bees that make me honey. It's just a super organism. All these little parts do their, you know, their small part to a bigger, you know, a bigger means. And once you understand that and can get that into your, you know, drill that into your brain, I think a lot of the stress will come off your shoulders, because you're not so worried about accidentally squishing this or knocking this over, or, oh, I think I accidentally squished my queen. It's like, well, now it's a chance for you to learn how to, you know, make new queens. Or if you want to take a practice, you know, take a stab at grafting. Hey, it's a great time. Now you're queenless. Or, you know, accidents give you ever opportunities to try things. And you just have to kind of come to grips with that.
Yeah. And, furthermore, given the opportunity, bees will reproduce and exist in nature like the ants do. Like a hive is not a thing that we have to have in order to have bees. The hive is just a thing that we put the bees in to make working with the bees more convenient for us. It's, mm-hmm. it's not for them.
Yeah. Around my area, especially around my house, you know, ants love to make, you know, their homes in walls of houses. It doesn't, you know, or underneath, you know, a piece of metal out in the yard. It doesn't really matter where they're at. It's still the same thing. So whether it's, you know, bees in a hive or in a tree or in a wall, it's just one big, you know, superorganism. And you just kind of have to look at everything that way, and, you know, life will be a lot easier.
We can hope.
Yeah, hope.
Things are changing. But we're getting out there. We're doing, you know, when I started, there were just a handful of treatment-free beekeepers around. And they were all still mostly just trying to figure out how to get their bees to survive over winter before they could even do the other stuff. And now it's gotten to the, you know, I've been keeping bees for 14 years, and it's just like, I'd love to just stop talking about treatment-free beekeeping, because it's just beekeeping for me. You know, I was out yesterday, like you were talking about earlier with nukes and feeding and stuff. When I was in Arkansas, when I could graft in, say, late March or something and have nukes ready by the end of May, I wouldn't have to feed them at all, and everything would be wonderful, and it's all great. Unfortunately, here, it gets so dry by the end of May that you lose a lot of your forage. And so, like, my nucleus hives, they just kind of barely survive over summer. And so I'm trying to develop a new marketing scheme where I'm getting bees ready for winter. And then, instead of producing nukes and then selling them directly, I'm thinking of trying to overwinter nukes and then selling them next year, and I can get them out earlier and people can get their hives started better. But in order to do that, like, those nukes can't just barely survive over the winter. And so, I was out feeding syrup yesterday because it's at the very minimum, it's an experiment to see what I have to do to make this style of beekeeping work here. Now, if I wasn't producing nukes, if I wasn't worried about that at all, if I was just not doing the nuke part and just doing the swarm part, then it would be no issue at all. I wouldn't have to feed anything. The swarms catch sure. The swarms, they do fine. They have a better start on life than the nukes do. So, it's being pragmatic, and I'd prefer not to feed, and I definitely prefer that the bees not go into winter eating sugar syrup rather than honey, because that's not as healthy for them. But this is what I got to do right now.
Sure. Yeah. And here, the last couple of years, I've had a lot of problems getting queens mated and to return earlier in the year. Earlier this spring, you know, getting into, you know, late April into May, I think I did. I artificially swarmed my one remaining hive. I think I made 20 nukes off of it. I believe I had 3 come back, and then a week later, one took off on me again.
Ouch.
All the queens are and it happened last year. All the queens hatch. They all leave. They don't make it back. So I thought, well, maybe it was spacing in my nukes. I had them too tight. The coloring, but, you know, I make all my own stuff. And I paint different colors. I put different colors of discs on the front by the entrances. I tried alternating, you know, every box pointing the complete different direction so they wouldn't just accidentally walk into one. No luck. You know, the ones I did get to take then, I didn't need to feed. They're fine right now. They're in, you know, double boxes. And the same thing happened to me last year. And then just like last year, this year, just a few weeks ago, well, within the last, like, 3 weeks or so, you know, I grafted. Oh, my timeline's so off. I grafted recently, I'll put it that way. And, yeah, time just blurs together anymore. And I've checked that they've hatched, and a lot of them have already come back, and I've had a few start laying already, which really surprised me. Here, for some reason, or at least where my house is in this little area, I'll have queens that, you know, they'll hatch and come back, and you'll see them in your nukes. You know, you'll wait a couple weeks to let them, you know, really get it kicked into high gear and ready to start laying, and you think they're duds. But if you wait 2 or 3 more weeks, then they really start to lay. I mean, I have queens that'll take 4 to 5 weeks before I know if they're even any good up here.
Yeah.
Which is, it's kind of odd, but
I experienced the same thing.
Seems like up here it happens every year. So this year, other than the couple of nukes I really had going, if I want any, have any chance of anything being built up in time for our goldenrod bloom, because we usually get a good goldenrod bloom here in the late summer, early fall, I can usually take 2 excess supers goldenrod off every hive, generally, you know, if the weather works out. I've got to feed these things and try to get them up to working force that's, you know, big enough to take advantage of that when it hits, so they have fall stores. And since I'm doing a lot of foundationless, you know, they have all that extra wax to draw out. And, you know, if it's dry and hot outside, it's kind of hard to find the resources to do that without feeding.
Yeah, there used to be a certain temperature when they pretty much just quit working.
Yeah. So, like, right now, I know all my queens aren't coming back. So I'm trying to get everybody to build as much as they can. I'll probably wait until the end of this month just to give everybody a few extra weeks to make sure, you know, if they're going to lay or not. And then I'll start condensing everything and, you know, taking what comb I can get from where and, you know, kind of jockeying it around and making what hives I can out of it. I've already stolen so much excess honey from my one good hive coming into this year to feed over nukes that, you know, there's no chance I'm getting excess off that thing. I can't touch it anymore. I've got to leave it alone to get it ready for winter. So for my nukes, it's feed or basically let them starve at this point.
Well, what should we talk about next?
Well, I've got lots of soapbox things that you can't say on the internet.
Whatever you want to say, man.
So my Facebook and my YouTube page, I go by The Bearded Beekeeper, but I've had a lot of people tell me I should go by The Angry Beekeeper because I'm always mad about something, apparently.
Well, let's get your...
I don't think I'm mad. I think I'm just... You know, tell life like it is, but apparently being angry. I tell them I'm not a pessimist. I'm a realist, and reality kind of stinks sometimes.
Yeah, that's what I said. What did I say in Wisconsin? Maybe I got it from Adrian Quiney. He said a realist is just a pessimist with good PR.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So
tell us about the angry beekeeper. I want to hear this.
I'm just always complaining and griping about things. There's things I should not say on here because I know lots of people that listen. or at least enough people that listen that it would get around. What kind of things, tips, ideas? If you know, I highly recommend joining a local beekeeping club. Don't believe everything they say. Just listen, absorb. You know, you need to learn and go out on your own and find things out for yourself as well. Because as great as they are, they can, you know, be just as bad. I mean, it's just like, you know, YouTube mentoring, you know, like videos I'm making. I think they're good videos. I mean, they're not the greatest, you know, video quality, but hopefully I'm not making really bad information, but there are people that do. So just kind of be wary about what what new beekeepers watch and what they do. It's good to get involved with your local club. If you have one that's not, you know, pro treatment all the time, just beats it into you. And you know, if they're more just kind of open to everybody, it's good to help out where you can. Just be cautious that, just like any other organization, there's always a handful of people that do all the work. And unless you have the time to give up to get sucked into doing all the work, just kind of be wary about what you volunteer for. What else?
Yeah, I've recently decided that I'm not a group person.
I don't go to a lot of meetings anymore because I have to bite my tongue, and I say that eventually the end of my tongue's going to fall off from biting it so hard. So it's just better to stay home. Which I know that's not going to make some people happy to hear that, but it's the truth.
Yeah. One of the other things that I've done in the beekeeping realm, especially lately, is that I don't consume beekeeping information. I produce beekeeping information. So I'm out keeping bees, trying new things every year, honing my skills, making my stuff more efficient. I'm going out and talking to groups. But I don't read the magazines. I don't go. Yeah. I'm at a certain point. You know, I've been doing this for a long time. I know what I'm doing. I know how to do what I'm doing. I don't really need to go find out what other people are doing. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm not in competition with anybody. I'm just doing what I want to do. And, you know, I don't need a magazine to tell me that certain whatever, you know, I just don't. I do my own thing, and I produce this. So I'm getting information out to people, but I just don't consume beekeeping media.
Yeah. When I first started out, I definitely read a lot then. I don't really so much anymore. Michael Bush's book, I read it. I like some of the books by Dr. Connor. He has some good books on, you know, on increasing your bees and swarms. You know, for somebody who doesn't know a lot about them, it's a good read. I'm the same way anymore. It's just kind of trial and experiment at home. Kind of keep everything to yourself until you know if it's going to work or not. Then kind of let other people know about it if they're interested, and if they're not, then they're not. I do kind of have a pet peeve kind of about, and it's a big topic everywhere, I guess, honey prices, what honey should sell for. And I know that there's a difference from selling, you know, buckets to other businesses to use, and they need to get their cut and their profit, and like me going to farmer's market and selling it. But I think in general, it seems like we're still, how to put it, we're still undervaluing our honey. And I wish more people would make honey a premium, give it a premium price because of all the work that's involved with it.
Especially for a premium product.
Yeah, I mean, understand if your primary business is pollination and honey is in excess and you sell it in bulk to, you know, other middlemen, you know, that's fine. That's what it is. I mean, you have to do that. But somebody selling at a farmer's market for half of what I'm selling mine for, and they, you know, relatively the same size as me, and it's a hobby just like that. I wish that we could all kind of come to a consensus on more of a baseline. And I know it's affected by what your market will pay. I know somebody in Tulsa, Oklahoma that sells the same size jar I do. I sell pints for $12. He sells them for $20. It's just, you know, what the market is. He always tells me, oh, you should load your honey up, drive to Tulsa, go to the the trendiest part of town and slap a $20 label on it and you'll fly off the table. But at the same time, I'm not going to go up there and sell it for $6 and undercut them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's, you always see posts online everywhere about, you know, what should I sell my honey for? I really wish we could figure out a way to say, you know, if you're your own person, if you're selling your own honey on a small scale, this should be at least the minimum. If you want to go over that, fine, but kind of come to a consensus on a minimum price at least, just to try to help everybody out. I mean, I know people that sell gallons of honey for $44 a gallon.
Jeez.
I know people that sell, yeah. And when I run out of honey and somebody asks me for honey, there's this pretty good honey. It's not all chemicaled up. I'll say, you know, I'm out, but such and such has some, and I'll send them to them because, you know, he has it right now. But next year when they come to me to buy some early in the spring, it's, well, why am I going to pay you $12 for a jar when I can go buy a gallon from him for 44 or 40 or whatever it is this year? So as much as I want to send people to other beekeepers I know to help them fill out what they need when I'm out, sometimes I can't because I know I'm going to undercut myself next year. So I'm not helping them out. I'm not helping out my friend sell his excess. You know, it's just a tough, you know, line. I mean, it's hard to stay right there. You don't really know what you should do with it. And I know people that sell it for less than that. I know some people that'll say, well, you know, I have four hives and I have two or three excess gallons. I could care less. I would just give it away. So I'm going to sell it for $5 a pint. It's like, okay, you know, that's your honey. You do what you want with it. That's fine. But just realize that the rest of us around that are selling, what kind of damage you're doing to us. And of course, you know, it's not my primary business. So if it takes me 6 months to sell my honey when I have it, it's not going to hurt me. I mean, I basically take my honey sales and put it back into buying more wood, you know, to make boxes out of or whatever. But some people, you know, that is a decent chunk of their income, and it does affect them, even if they're not, you know, on the commercial scale. And I try to keep that in mind when I'm selling honey to people, and you know, they'll tell me, well, I can go to Sam's and get this Zubi honey or whatever for this price, and I just kind of nicely smile and say, okay, well, okay. Why are you telling me? Basically, you're just trying to price gouge me. You should have went to the store and bought it in the first place. It's just kind of how it is. Yep. I'm going to sell out eventually, regardless. So, sorry. And they seem to get really mad about that. Or, you know, if I buy two jars, can I get a discount? I'm like, well, no, you can pay for two jars. Or what really gets me is, and it's probably more common than not, say you have a pint for 12, and then you sell, I know people that sell a pint for 12, sell a quart for 18. It's like it's double the amount of honey, but you're only selling it, the second part of it, at half the price. And I can understand if you're selling, you know, 50, you know, 5 gallon drums or 55 gallon drums, that bulk pricing comes into effect. But for that reason, I only sell pints because I don't want to undercut myself. And I just don't understand why people do that all the time. I don't get it.
That's a good point. Well, I guess it's that kind of mentality of buying in bulk. But you have to remember, I tell people all the time, if you're not a commercial beekeeper, don't keep bees like you're a commercial beekeeper. You're not a commercial beekeeper. Do it differently. Do it like you need to do it. The reason why bulk works, you know, the reason why you can get stuff cheaper in bulk at Costco or Sam's Club, I guess you're in Sam's Club area.
Yeah, Sam's Club.
I'm in Costco area out here. Anyway, the reason why it works that way is because when you take, you know, if you sell, I don't know, an 8 ounce bottle of dish detergent, you know, it takes a certain amount of money to make that bottle. So if you sell that same dish detergent by the gallon, the cost of the bottle isn't all that much more. So you can give a discount because you're not spending so much on the bottle. And if you get a big, big volume, you know, if you repeat that, you know, if you're selling, if you're selling 100,000 gallons of dish detergent versus a million little bottles of dish detergent, you know, it goes up with economies of scale. But with our honey stuff, you know, I forget the prices exactly, but a pint jar costs, you know, like 60 cents and a quart jar costs like 80 cents. So mm-hmm. by selling a quart, you're gaining like 20 cents. Now, prices may be different. This is just last time I checked. But you're only saving like 20 cents, but now you're selling half of your honey half off. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So the worst that I've done, let's see, when I was in Arkansas, I would sell a pint for 12 and a quart for 20. That's still not quite there, but it's kind of even numbers. It was easier to do the money.
Yeah, when I did quarts for a year, and I would sell them for 22 to give them a couple dollar discount to make them feel a little better about it, but it still wasn't, you know, 16 or 18. It wasn't as drastic. So I was basically, you know, discounting my pint jars, you know, a buck or so a jar. So
and quart jars are a little easier to deal with.
Yeah,
because they're bigger. But right here, I sell it for what? I do pint for 15 and quart for 25. But yeah, this is something that we really need to pay attention to. When people ask the question, how much should I sell my honey for? And if it's not your, if you don't have to make the money, like if this isn't your job, my rule of thumb when I was selling honey back in Arkansas, and still is, because it's not my main income, is, you know, in Arkansas, I harvested in June. My goal would be to be out of honey by June. And so whatever price that I could charge and still sell out of honey by June, that's the price. So that was a whole year to sell everything that I had.
Yeah. I mean, I always tell people there's no shame in being the most expensive, because if you're the most expensive, you can always come down a little bit if you need to get rid of it. But it's hard to come up dollars at a time, you know, and recoup that loss.
That's exactly right.
So, you know, if you're trying to sell for 15 and it's getting to be December, you're like, hey, you know, maybe I should do a fall little festival and mark it down to 11. So I'm not stuck with it all coming into the next, you know, the next go around, but.
And then you can put up a big handwritten sign that says everything's 25% off or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. You can do the department store. Everything's always 40% off year round.
Yeah. You're learn how to manipulate your customers, yeah. Basically.
So what, let's see, what's your opinion on, and I've had this question asked to me when, and you may have covered it in a podcast and it's been so long, I just forgot. When people come up and ask you, so, you know, will this help my allergies? Is this local enough to help my allergies? What kind of reply do you usually give them?
Ouch. That's one of the good ones. Well, for many years,
I'll tell you what I tell them. I will tell them that, you know, say a lady comes up and says, you know, I really love local honey. You know, it really helps me with my allergies. And, you know, what do you think? And I'll just say, well, you know, people have told me that it seems to help them. You know, I haven't seen any studies that says, you know, it's definite, but people say it helps. And, you know, if you think it helps, it helps. I know I can't really say either way on it. For the most part, they seem satisfied with that. For the most part.
Here's the way I've approached it. I'm a very honest person. I abhor lying or even lies of omission. So I used to, because the fact is that the studies show that local honey does not help with allergies versus placebo. That's the fact of the science that's been done. So for many years, I would get questions like, people say that it works, local honey works for allergies. I was like, yeah, that's what people say. I mean, that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And just not comment on whether or not it actually. But then this last year, actually, it was. I've been getting into studying human cognition and brain science and things. And it came to me And I may have mentioned this on the podcast at some point in the past. I don't remember. But it came to me that placebos still work in like 30% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
So if you give somebody a sugar pill and tell them it's aspirin, they will get the effect of aspirin at least 30% of the time. So the fact is, when you give somebody honey that's local, the science says that it doesn't really do anything for your allergies, but the science also says that the placebo does something for your allergies. So I kind of just let it go. Like, it doesn't matter to me anymore. If you think that honey helps with your allergies, then buy this honey and it will help with your allergies. If you think it's local or if it's not local or whatever you think, it really is just as effective. I'm not going to tell you this will help you with your allergies.
Yeah, as long as you're not putting it on a sign saying, you know, helps local allergies, or, you know, just leave it in their hands and they can believe what they want to believe, and you're not really deceiving them, as long as you're not, you know, falsely advertising the effects of it.
And I'm not charging any more or any less. It's just, and the other thing is, if I tell them that local honey doesn't help with allergies, then if they eat it, then the chances that it does help with allergies will actually be reduced. Not completely to zero, because some people can be told that it is a sugar pill and it will still work. But it's less effective than if they're told it's medicine. So it's still a slight moral quandary for me, but if people want to buy local honey and take it for their allergies and it works for them, then great. I don't want to ruin people's expectations, because the science does show that it does work for a lot of people. I mean, that's, placebos work. That's why placebos exist. We shouldn't discount the fact that something doesn't work better than placebo when placebo works too for a lot of people.
Sure.
I mean, we shouldn't pretend that that's not the case. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it's not like, like alternative medicine or some things that science shows doesn't, I'm not going to advertise this as working, but anyway.
I just thought of something that I can't believe I didn't think of earlier.
What's that?
Pet peeve. People selling local nukes that have been overwintered in other states and brought back.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Drives me nuts. It's like, and I've had people tell me, oh, no, they were made here. And then, you know, they're taken down when it's warmer, and then they're brought back. So I mean, they're local. They're from here. They're raised here. They went out and made it here. It's like, yeah, but they're not overwintered here. So where do you draw that line of calling something local? Is it local because it's overwintered locally, or local because it's bred from the bees in that locale?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I don't want bees for here that have to deal with winter here. I mean, the winter here is not as harsh as in some other places, but like when I was in Arkansas, you're in Arkansas, your winter is oftentimes brutal and short.
Mm-hmm.
The places where those bees are raised is mild and short. And if those bees are being shipped up to somewhere, you know, like Wisconsin, their winter is brutal and long. And so you're taking bees that have had just this really soft, mild winter. And then you take them up to Wisconsin and you can't get bees to survive up there because they're of such different acclimatization. I'm not sure if that's even the right word. They have different genetic makeup, so they don't have the skills needed necessarily all the time without a lot of help. Good experienced beekeepers can do it artificially, but for new beekeepers, especially when you're hauling, when I was up there, I talked to a trucker guy who was one of his main businesses is hauling packages to Wisconsin from California. Now, I live in Southern Oregon, where the weather's pretty mild and wet. These bees are coming from Northern California, where the weather is even milder and less wet. And then they're going to Wisconsin, where the rivers freeze over in the wintertime. That's unheard of here. That does not happen. The lakes don't even freeze over here. You at least, you get some ice on the river. Your ponds freeze over and stuff. It's a little worse. When I was in Arkansas, I got temperatures down to zero briefly. You can actually go several days without getting above freezing. That's unheard of here. So it's totally unheard of down in Alabama or Mississippi or Northern California or Georgia, where a lot of the bees come from. So those bees to me are, I don't even want them, and I'm certainly not going to pay for them.
Yeah, see, that's one of the big things I try to tell new beekeepers when they ask, you know, where should I get bees? It's like, no matter where you get them from, ask questions, and you need to ask specific questions. You know, don't just ask, you know, are these bees local? Because I've had spirited debates, if you want to put it that way, with other people that sell nukes that say that, well, you know, these bees were open mated with, you know, drones from, let's say, Van Buren, just for instance, but, you know, not around here. Say from Van Buren. I took them to South Texas for the wintertime. I brought them back to Van Buren. They've bred with bees that are made for this environment. You shouldn't have any problems. What are you complaining about? They're local. And, you know, new beaks will go out and say, you know, I want to buy 3 nukes. Are they local? And they're like, oh, yeah, sure. They're open mated here. You know, they lay here. They're from here. All the bees they mate with are from here. But if they ask, you know, where were they overwintered? Were they overwintered here? A lot of times you're going to get a no. But you know, we don't teach new beekeepers to ask where they're kept different times of the year. We just say, buy local bees. And they don't, you know, always necessarily know that there's a difference. And it's some people, I think, do it purposely, you know, to be kind of shady about it. And others, you know, they're not. I mean, they're just saying, hey, you know, the bees are from here. That's what you're asking me. You're not asking me, you know, where they slept when it was snowing up here. And it's just, it's something we need to inform new beekeepers more about that, because, you know, they might think they're getting, you know, bees from here that are overwintered here. They invest a lot of money. You know, they die because they have no idea what to do in the cold. And then, you know, that discourages brand new, you know, new beekeepers that second year. They're like, you know, what's the point if I'm buying bees and they're going to die here? I bought the local ones. I couldn't even keep the local ones alive. I'm just going to throw in the towel. And, you know, we all see that every year, you know, people that don't make it out of their first year or into the spring of their second year, and they just quit, and you see all their stuff for sale on Facebook cheap. And, you know, the experienced beekeepers come in and buy everything up at a good deal, and we all wait for it. But we need to educate them more in what to ask for and what to look for. Oh, it seems like a lot of the new beginner beekeeper classes will, they don't really get into even nukes. They'll just tell you, you know, to go out and get your package of bees. You can get a local nuke if you're lucky. You know, they're harder to come by, but just go buy a package, or, you know, buy a nuke that's local. The guy says they're from here. They're from his bees. You're good to go. You know, and it's not the case, and they just don't know any better. And I wish, you know, more of them would know to ask that. That would really help a lot of them out, I think.
I've graduated to the point to tell people, don't buy bees at all. Just do swarms. Just forget the buying the bees. I'm right here in the middle of suburbia. Okay. I'm on a quarter acre lot, and everybody around me is on quarter acre lots. There's no forest anywhere near here. Even open land, I'm a good, what, mile from, maybe, no, 2 miles maybe. 2 miles from open land, you know, farmland, whatever. I caught 4 swarms on my back porch this year. Just with basic swarm traps, just an old box, 1 frame of comb, 9 frames of foundation, and a swarm lure made out of lemongrass oil. That's it.
Yeah.
There's no reason to buy bees for me anymore. T- to tell anybody to buy bees.
Don't say that, because I still sell a few nukes every year. You can't tell everybody that.
Well, that's the great thing is the people will still buy it anyway.
Yeah. Say, you know, I'm not doing it this year because I'm rebuilding, but, you know, I if people ask where to buy them, I try to point them to somebody who's local that I know, who I know that, you know, they make some excess every year. Like, I might sell 10, if you know, in a normal year, I might sell 10 nukes a year, maybe. That's, you know, a lot for me, because I'm not in the business to do that, but I'll make some extra nukes and sell them to pay or, you know, to pay for frames or whatever, so I'm not just constantly, you know, burning through money to do this,
mm-hmm.
just to support the hobby. So, you know, so I'll send them to people like me that have, you know, 20 or 30 hives, and, you know, if you ask them if they have a nukes for sale, they might say, oh, no, but, you know, I can make you one up, and you know they're coming from there, and they've been overwintered there. I mean, that's about the only place I would say to buy bees from.
Oh, yeah. That, if well, somebody like saying, says I can make you one up, that's generally a pretty good source.
Yeah, like mine, if you're really hurting for one, I'll go out to a big hive, you know, that's got a first-year queen in it. I'll pull 5 good frames of brood and honey out and make sure the queen's with it, put them in, shake a ton of bees in it for you. There you go. There's your nuke. When I'm making more queens for myself, I'll replace her, or I'll break that hive down and spread it out and make 3 or 4 nukes out of it, because I was going to make nukes for me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that big a deal.
You also, with swarms, you're almost 100% guaranteed to have a queen who survived the previous winter.
Yes, definitely. Well, there's been a big thing going on around here on some of the more local groups lately. Big controversy about people catching swarms, sticking them in nuke boxes, and turning around and selling them as nukes. Got any opinion on that, Ivory?
That seems pretty dishonest to me. I know people that will catch swarms and sell them as swarms, and that's fine. Yeah, but catching a swarm and selling it as a nuke, I mean, buyer beware. You're going to have crooks. You're going to have bad guys. You're going to have people who are dishonest. You're going to have people whose sole purpose in life is to separate you from your money. And if you don't realize that, then you're going to get separated from your money.
Yeah.
The old proverb, a fool and his money are soon parted.
Yeah. Let's see. Tinkering out of my head here. If you're going to spend the money on an extractor, don't go cheap. Buy a good quality extractor.
Right.
You're going to regret it. I mean, you're going to regret it so fast you wouldn't believe it, and you can't get rid of it after that, because, you know, unless you find somebody else that doesn't know any better and buys it from you, but well, I haven't bought an extractor.
You can give them away.
Yeah.
I think I've gotten 2 of them that have been given to me.
So, yeah, I haven't bought an extractor yet. You know, in our club, we have, you know, I think 3 extractors that we loan out to members to use. You know, they're good for hobby. You know, if you have a couple of hives, but I'm going to wait and buy myself a nicer one, because that gets really old trying to chase that thing down and fixing things and fighting with stuff. And, you know, if you're looking at a nice shiny extractor, you know, your first year, and there's a lot of people around here that'll go out and buy an extractor before they even get their bees.
Oh yeah, bad plan.
You know, stop. There's so many people that go out and buy so much stuff before they ever have a bee, and then 6 months later they quit. You know, there's lots of things you can put off for 2, 3, 4 years if you really wanted to.
Oh, yeah. Here's my rule with extractors. Number one, do not buy a tangential extractor. Just don't do it. Just don't do it. Don't buy one. Do not buy an extractor until you need a minimum of, say, like a 9/18. So 18 medium or 9 deep. That's what I bought. Do not buy an extractor until you need that. Until you are so sick and tired of doing what, you know, doing crush and strain, or doing, if you've got so many hives and are making so much honey, do not buy it until you need a bigger, at least a small medium range radial extractor.
Yeah, and there's a man that you know, that you probably know, in the southern part of Arkansas, that his family's been keeping bees for, you know, generations. And him and his wife, every day, they have a two-frame extractor. And that's what they use every single time they've ever extracted for decades. And they do a 55-gallon drum a day. That is crazy. And I'm talking like, you know, I'm talking like 1,500 hives kind of numbers at one point in the earlier days. You know, now they're older and, you know, they've really reduced down and their sons do more of the operation. But I don't think you, I don't know if you could pay me to do that.
No.
Frames at a time, 55 gallons a day.
What happened with me is I had somebody like that who had bought too much stuff and then quit gave me a four frame tangential extractor, and I used that for the first year. Up until, when did I buy that one? Up until 2011, maybe. You know, when I was making like a couple of gallons of honey a year. And then it got to the point where I was out in my shed, which liked to run at about 108 degrees at 98% humidity. I measured. And it just got to the point where, wow, this is terrible. So I'm going to buy a bigger extractor. And then I took the extra step of buying Man Lakes 918 extractor, which you can also buy an upgrade kit to make it motorized. And I thought, well, I'm going to, you know, in a few years, I'll probably be making enough honey and I'll buy the motorized kit when the time comes along. Well, life ended up happening to me and I ended up moving and not doing a whole lot of beekeeping for a few years. And so I never needed the motorized kit. The hand crank works just fine. I may get to the point here in the next 2 or 3 years when it does get to the point where I need the motorized kit. And when the motorized kit is needed, then that's when I will get the motorized kit. But until then, I don't need it.
See, what you need to do, like this year, I went down to Galveston to the National Beekeeping Show. You can get some really good deals on that kind of stuff down there. You need to walk down with a big stack of cash, walk in and start throwing it around and pick up a nice extractor cheap.
Nice. That's the other thing about selling stuff. Learn some tips about selling stuff. You know, learn about, you know, if you want $25 a quart, then start at $30 a quart and let people make you a deal. Yeah, you know, if you want to sell a car for a few thousand, add $1,000 and let people talk you down.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll get somebody comes along and thinks they're just going to hand you the whole wad of cash and then great. Fantastic.
Yeah. That'd be nice.
But you know, you can make other people feel better about their purchase. Number one. And if people don't want to haggle or whatever, then you make a little extra money. Sure. But having a wad of cash helps. Hey, I got this wad of cash right here.
Oh, that always helps, especially
I'll give
those nice
you some of it.
Yeah, those nice full size extracting track like enclosed trailers, or that goes in one end and comes out the other end. Those are really nice.
Yeah,
no, I took a tour of one of those. Those are, you know, that's what you need right there. Just get on that.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, don't buy stuff until you need it. Like to keep bees, buy hives. Well, you can even start with used stuff from Facebook or Craigslist or whatever. If you're gonna, I do recommend one of the things that I think people don't buy big enough. Probably the only thing that I think people don't buy enough is a smoker. Get the big commercial smoker. It's only a couple dollars more than a regular smoker. Do not get the small smoker. They're junk. I have one. I'll give to you if you want it. Get the big smoker. They're easier to light. They stay lit for longer. I've had mine for 14 years now. Just replaced the bellows this year. Get the big smoker.
Now, talking about smokers, I have the little smoker like you're talking about, little dome top. And I use wood pellets in it because of that fact. I used to not ever have enough material in it. Yeah. But what I'm starting to use now, I have a one of the German pipe smokers, an Imker 5.
Ooh.
I love that thing. Because when I have my big smoker going, I mean, with my pellets, it'll burn for 4 hours. And I may only use it 5 minutes out of those 4 hours. Because I really don't use it ever when I take the lid off, just to kind of get that initial, you know, the atmosphere getting sucked out of their hive and that initial shock, just to kind of get them out of my way. So with my little Imker, I can just pick it up and put a little butane lighter under it, puff in it a couple times, seal off the bottom and close it off, and the fire goes out. I have a small one, and when I put, and I don't smoke, but I use rough cut chewing or pipe tobacco in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a one way valve, so you can't suck it back in. So I get minimal exposure to this when I puff a little bit out. And here you can't really find the veils that have the cutout already made to put the little tip through to your mouth. But on my beekeeping veil, it's such a soft mesh. I can put that in my mouth, and as long as I don't use my teeth, if I just wrap my lips around it, I can blow it right through my veil without a problem.
Where did you get that?
I got it from a guy out east. I'd have to search for his card. I still have it somewhere. He brings him over from Germany. And I think I don't know if he does anymore. At one time he brought some over, and I happened to run across him and tracked him down and messaged him, and he had some left at that time. It's been about a year. They're kind of a little tricky to get used to. There's not instructions with them. It was just trying to figure it out. And I couldn't find any videos online of how to do it. So I made a YouTube video showing how to pack it and how to actually light it and blow it and how much it puts out. But, yeah, I love that thing. I have my toolkit is just a little plastic ammo box. And I keep, you know, some frame grippers, a J-hook tool in it. I keep a serrated knife for cutting queens out. And I keep that little smoker in, and I keep tobacco in it, and I keep it and a little lighter inside of my little box. And that's pretty much all I need, you know, 90% of the time. The only time I really use my big smoker anymore is when I'm making nukes, and I know I'm going to need it just kind of here and there, and it's just easier to have one going all the time at that point. But anymore, I mean, I love that thing, and it's aluminum. It has a heat shield on it to where I can touch it with my bare hand and blow on it, and it doesn't get hot enough to burn me.
Nice. That's interesting. Yeah, I don't use a lot of smoke. I have the smoker going there when I need to. So I get out to the yard, I fire it up. I basically usually just sit it on top of a hive, and most of the time it never gets used. But if it's there if I need it. And then yesterday when I was feeding this time of year, or any time of year when there's a dearth or a lack of blooms going on, you're in danger of getting robbing. So what I did was I went around and smoked all the big hives, the ones that were probably going to rob out my nukes that I was trying to feed. So mm-hmm. Smoked them all, and that kind of, they, you know, they get all confused and they worry about their own business for a while. And hopefully none of the nukes got robbed, but, the small smokers, they're hard to keep going unless you've got like a manufactured fuel, like the pellets. You know, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. I want to use wood chunks from sawing stuff up. So I like the big one. And what I do is, I have myself a propane torch, a little clicker, fires right up, stick that in there, puff it a little bit, get it going. Easiest way to do it. Throw some fresh wood chunks on top of it, and let it run. And then when I'm done, I have a little chunk of wood that I have carved to fit, and it just plugs off the nozzle. And so you have that nice charcoal in there. It's real easy to start up with a torch and save it for next time.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I do with the pellets. I just have a little cork that fits in the end. It's an old champagne cork that I kind of took a knife to and just kind of taper the end on it. And I just plug it in to put the fire out. Save it for next time.
Well, what's your YouTube channel so we can get that out for everybody to check out your videos?
It's V, you know, like T-H-E, you know, V, Bearded Bee.
The Bearded Bee.
Yeah, and it's the same as my Facebook page is the same. And I actually have a website that doesn't have very much on it right now. There's 3 or 4 pages. It's just some information.
What's your website?
It's just beardedbee.org. So when things slow down this fall and I have more time, I'm actually got some plans to do some stuff with it. But just right now, it's busy season at work and a family business, and there's just no time for that kind of stuff right now.
Awesome. Well, we've gone well over an hour, and my family's probably going to be showing up here in a minute. So,
yeah, my boys are already popping their head in the door looking at me.
Nice.
But yeah, I guess the one thing I want to say in regards to mentors, I was thinking, you know, new beekeeper or not, just keep in mind that there's not always one right way to do something, but there's definitely a few wrong ways to do it.
Yep.
And no matter how you and your mentor click, just keep in mind, you know, what they're telling you really doesn't work. Just kind of keep that in mind. And then everything else, you can just kind of figure out your own beekeeping style as you go over time, and you'll figure out something that works for you in the long run.
Be humble and ask before you do something.
That would always be nice.
Yeah. Don't come ask, help me, something went wrong. How about just ask before you do it? And we'll talk about it, and then you can go and make your mistakes and learn your lessons. If you go do it before you ask, then you're gonna make a lot of mistakes. You'd be lucky, very lucky, if you don't have something major go wrong that you could have learned from someone who's already done it themselves.
Yeah, and if you have a grumpy mentor like me, I'm gonna be the one who goes, "Why did you do that? What were you thinking?" I'm not gonna be real super sweet about it, so that's gonna be something else that you're not going to like have happen.
See, in me, I'm not going to chew you out. Probably. I'll just probably want to stop talking to you.
Well, that's me. I'm not going to chew you out, but I'm going to get kind of annoyed by it. And yeah, there's after, you know, 10 times of getting really annoyed by stuff, it's hard to keep trying to help someone at that point.
Yep. Yep. Be humble. Don't try to tell your mentor what's up. Listen to them. Accept what they say. If you don't want to do it that way, if you disagree with them, fine. Keep it to yourself, or maybe find a mentor that
is nice, not mean.
Someone who's more aligned with what you're trying to do. And if they did tell you something and you messed it up anyway, don't come back for help, because you're just going to, admit what you did. You know, your mentor is going to be a lot happier with you said, "I know you told me not to do this, but I did it anyway. I'm sorry. I need help." Like, I can totally accept that. But if you come back to me and say, "I did this, I don't know what went wrong, and I told you what was going to go wrong beforehand," I'm not going to be happy.
Yep. It's listening skills.
Listening skills. Remembering skills.
That would be nice.
And we're not trying to say this stuff to be mean. Like, want to help, but some people make it hard to help.
Well, it's just like, you know, there's some people that aren't, you know, really shouldn't, and you really shouldn't have pets. There's some people that are better suited not to have kids. There's going to be some people that bees just really aren't their forte. And I mean, it happens.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
Learn that before you buy $1,000 in equipment.
Yeah, that's one of those, if you need to get rid of a couple of tools and a few boxes after the first year, it's you know, you're not out $1,000.
All right. Oh, by the way, I'll have Mike's YouTube channel and website in the show notes at tfb.podbean.com. I do apologize. The last couple of episodes, I said I was going to have stuff in show notes, and then I cleaned my desk and I lost my notes. I apologize. I'm sorry about that. That's all there is
sure.
to it.
Yeah, sure. We believe you. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, if you saw my desk right now, you'd believe me.
You don't want to see mine at work. There is no desk. It's just a pile.
I've got about 25 chocolate candy wrappers, piles of paper. Look, there's my commercial driving manual, commercial license manual. Yeah, I've got, lots of fun stuff. A cluttered desk is a sign of a cluttered mind.
True.
Well, Mike, thank you. I appreciate it. And thank you for all your hard work in moderating the Treatment-Free Beekeeping groups. Appreciate you taken some time, and especially out of your very busy schedule. Thank you for being on the show.
Well, happy to be here.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of the Treatment Free Beekeeping Podcast. My executive producer is Adam Blitz, and this show is brought to you by him and the other patrons at patreon.com/TFB. If you want to support the show, you can become a patron too and get access to the TFB pub on Facebook. The show is produced and edited and engineered by me. The music is by Jeb Botiford. If you want a jingle for your project, you can find him on Twitter at Jeb Botiford. Don't follow me on Twitter. I don't post bee stuff there, so you're not missing anything. The Facebook group can be found at facebook.com/treatmentfreebeekeepers. You can find treatment-free beekeeping videos at my channel on youtube.com/treatmentfreebeekeeping. The Treatment Free Beekeeping Forum is located at forum.tfbees.net. My website is parkerbees.com, and my rarely updated blog is at parkerbees.blogspot.com. Thanks again for joining me. I'm Solomon Parker. Have fun keeping bees, because if you're not having fun, maybe model railroading would be a better hobby for you.